my paper is a little bit different in nature, because when I was considering what I would discuss today, I wanted to really sort of deliver something in the framework of a student conference. And being in the section to discuss mentalism, I thought it would be an interesting opportunity to discuss my experience with the mentalist framework and what sort of influence that has had on my intellectual development and the work that I hope to do. This is also an explanation of sorts to everyone in the room what exactly I do here. And with that caveat, it's probably as much an explanation to myself of that. Because as a graduate student, I'm frequently subject to one of the most terrifying inquiries for me. And it's the question, what are you studying? It terrifies me mostly because there's no answer for me that feels descriptive enough to the point of my satisfaction, nor is there a really casual answer that will prevent my interlocutor from dragging me down the rabbit hole of questions, the most popular of which is usually, well, how are you going to make that scientific? Mm. Consequently, I've become a master at politely diverting conversation. But at this point in my graduate student career, I feel like I shouldn't be like that anymore. This avoidance is no longer acceptable. And so it's time that I explain myself, make my purpose understood, and if I can't do it among the audience today, well, then I'm in trouble because it means I can't do it at all. As I was thinking about this apology of sorts, I wondered if some people who would be in the room today, close followers of Professor Greenfeld's work, who I've had the privilege to get to know and work with in the past couple years, have a clear idea of what I'm doing here. And as Professor Greenfeld knows, at least once a year, this is a question that I grapple with myself. So, as I said, I'm taking the opportunity today to feature the premises and promises of mentalism and what these implications, the themes that we've discussed over the course of the year have for neuroscience and particularly have had for me in wanting to do social neuroscience. Having said that, the title of my talk is also somewhat misleading because social neuroscience means two different things to me. At first, it meant, well, what it sounds like, social neuroscience. Neuroscientists who are interested in explaining social behavior of animals and humans. As most of us in this room know, we don't actually use those words in the same way. So after, you know, the ideas of mentalism become relevant and incorporated, the human social environment, as David explained, becomes a very, very different phenomenon. And so how do I have had over the past 3 years to somehow figure out how to try to reconcile that for myself and then what that is actually going to mean for the work that I want to go and do. So I suppose it makes sense to begin at the beginning. As most of you know, I was an undergraduate here at the University of Professors Program, where I studied cognitive science from an interdisciplinary perspective and did my senior thesis research on autism spectrum disorders and the postulated relationship with function in the mirror neuron system. The mirror neuron system was actually a really fascinating discovery in neuroscience in the mid-90s. A team of Italian researchers in the University of Parma ran a lab where they experimented with macaque monkeys by implanting electrodes in a region of the brain that had motor control over the hands and mouth. So thus, they were giving the monkeys various tasks, picking up grapes, eating them, putting them into their mouth, and reading the sort of output of activity that was coming from that, you know, anatomical region of the brain. What they found by accident, however, was that the exact same region of the brain would send activation signals when the monkeys observed researchers picking up the grapes and eating their lunch. So, I mean, you have this monkey who's sitting there completely motionless, and you're having the exact same data result from the reading that you were getting when the monkeys were actively involved in this type of action. And so this activation was so robust that it nearly mirrored the activation pattern initiated when the monkey himself was involved in the action, except the sort of corresponding movement. And after years of detailed mapping of this system, a network was described in primates and then later in humans that constructed a mirror of observed actions in relationship to the individual who was the observer. So now, cue evolutionary psychology, despite what we know about it now from David's fantastic talk, biological anthropologists such as Michael Tomasello were simultaneously postulating the development of a neuroanatomical mechanism in our evolutionary history that allowed us to understand the intentions and mental states of others. Psychologists, anthropologists, and neuroscientists alike wanted to explain how humans developed such an intricate and complex theory of mind. So the theory of mind refers to a psychological capacity, according to Michael Tomasello, which allows us to understand members of our species or group as acting rational beings like ourselves. So for the biological anthropologists and evolutionary psychologists, this development in our evolutionary history accounts for what Tomasello describes in his book as the cultural origins of human cognition. Now, neuroscience, the hard science of the 21st century, have begun to produce detailed answers about this phenomenon and very sexy pictures of it in functional magnetic resonance imaging. I was seduced by both of these paradigms and working with them when I came to my second modernity seminar in 2005 with Professor Greenfeld, and coincidentally, it was the first semester that she really started dealing with the topics of mental illness and the mind explicitly in the seminar. And I, of course, was very eager to share my knowledge of neuroscience, and I was relating the work being done in biology and anthropology to this thing called culture that we were constantly concerning ourselves with in the seminar. As many of the students in this room can recently relate, I was grilled. So after I explained to Professor Greenfeld in the seminar the work regarding the mirror neuron system and the hypotheses that culture springs from this ability to hold theory of minds, etc., in great technical detail, Professor Greenfeld calmly looked at me and said, "But all of this work doesn't explain anything. In science, as in logic, a condition is never a cause." Of course, I didn't understand fully the implications of what was being said, but I knew something really bad had just happened. And this was a huge problem in my understanding, and especially in my belief of the authority of all this other work that I was interested in. And I swear, I must have woken up saying in my sleep, "A condition is not a cause," you know? And this phrase actually would prove to be probably the most important foundation of my thought and my understanding today. Despite its apparent logical simplicity, sort of isolated just in logical argument, it's consistently overlooked in contemporary biology, neuroscience, and psychology. As we know from Professor Greenfeld's article, Invitation to a Dialogue, it was this logical problem that led her to formalize her hypothesis about the structure of the human mind and the mind's dependence on culture. In this article, Professor Greenfeld, as David has given us much of the background of sort of major tenets of mentalism, advocates for the recognition of culture as a reality sui generis. The gravity of this statement in this context was highlighted by her assertion in this article that neuroscience will not understand the human mind without taking culture into account. So this is actually what I came to graduate school to focus on. I came to learn all that I could about neuroscience, and I made an imaginary oath to Professor Greenfeld, in my mind, to always take the cultural reality into account, whatever that meant at the time. And specifically, as you know, we were examining her hypothesis that culture can be causal in certain types or states of mind, as seen in the instance of functional mental illness of unknown etiology. And my job, we both thought when I started here, was to ultimately design an experiment that showed something like different types of identities were represented differently in the brain of individuals in a way that implicated culture as its cause. I would become the sort of the trained neuroscientist, just as all other neuroscientists are, and I would use their methodology and their technology and their language to talk to them and to show them that this explanation has some weight to it and they should probably pay attention. But my job today is not so cut and dry. It actually didn't turn out to be that easy. And this was for a number of important reasons. The first reason for my shift away from this immediately experimental focus, which we all know that everybody thinks is the hallmark of science, was that Professor Eichenbaum called my attention to a group of literature that called itself social neuroscience. I was meeting up with him one day, explaining to him, you know, my reasons for coming back to graduate school, feeling that I had to justify myself for doing it with a sociologist to study neuroscience. And, you know, he looked at me very bluntly and said, well, this isn't very new. He said, there's a whole field of people who are interested in explaining things that are social. And at first, I was sort of hurt, and then I was very excited. Now I have this disciplinary home. I can go do science with these people, and we can study things that are social. And undoubtedly, this branch of neuroscience, social neuroscience, was stemming from the work on things like mirror neuron systems that was going on in the mid-90s. In combination with the technological advancements that we have now to look at the brain and to find out all of these different things about the biological evidence for the things that we do with our human brain. And so since neuroscience knew the mechanisms through which we interacted socially, social neuroscientists wanted to apply this functional knowledge to produce more sound descriptions of social phenomena and ask more fundamental questions about the human brain and mind. In the introduction to this enormous text, Foundations in Social Neuroscience, the editors, who are the fathers, sort of the priests, if you will, of this subdiscipline, assert that the institution of social neuroscience is oriented towards this addressing fundamental questions about the mind and its dynamic interactions with the biological systems of the brain and the social world in which it resides. It became very evident to me very quickly, though, that we were using the word social, as I said at the beginning, in completely different ways. I was confused at first by the fact that all of the work in this area, except very, very little, had dealt with animal studies, with rats and with monkeys. And for the neuroscientists, anything that was social was behavior that happened in groups. And, well, after many discussions with Professor Greenfeld about this, we know that, well, ants are social and bees are social. But there's something different that we do, and this is the thing that I am interested in looking into. And so this development, this problem for me, problem number two, if you will, happened at a time when we were doing a lot of work with Darwin and meticulously sort of going through the Origin of Species and Descent of Man. And it required me to understand what biology was doing, what biology is at its nature, and what its limitations are. And this was happening at the same time that I was spending a year at the medical school in clinically based classes and in biologically based classes that were going to train researchers and clinical subjects for neuroscience and human neuropsychology. And what mentalism provided for me was a tool that could become part of a game in these classes. I could sit in these classes and be exposed to the subject matter and the details that all of these people, these sort of biological technicians, these scientists were working with, and learn the details just as well as they could. But I could also sit there and play a game with myself where I said, well, is this biology or is this mentalist sociology? Which one does this need more? Very often when it's a class about, you know, the structure and function of neurons, it was completely contained in biology. All of the evidence, all of the language, all of the details made sense in a biological framework. You didn't need anything else. But then as soon as I would sit through a class on attention, so attention deficit disorder, or amnesia, for example, different types of traumatic brain injury amnesia. There were certain things that were very interesting that would happen that were not explained by the neuroscience, that weren't explained by the biology. And so I was in the unique position to say, well, what does this mean in terms, if it's placed into the framework of mentalist, of a mentalist perspective? And despite the fact that I realized and I learned that a lot of the premises of biology and neuroscience were producing roadblocks for attacking these really fundamental questions about the nature of the human mind and the nature of society and culture, that this mentalist framework had an enormous amount of promise for taking the evidence that neuroscience already has and reworking it in a way that made it consistent with the things that we wanted to explain. And so now this is actually where, this is where I am now, and this is what I see my purpose as being. That Professor Greenfeld, as we're familiar with through the past year's Midjourney seminars, has been working in the incidence of functional mental illness as a subset of evidence for certain types of human minds and its relationship to culture in a causal way. And what I have realized, because it was very hard to take classes in mental illness, I actually just was taking classes in psychiatry and neurobiology and things, that so much of normal human functioning, that so much of the data that we have about normal human neuroscience can be reworked and reframed in this framework to open up new experimental paradigms and things that have constantly been matters of debate. So as actually Chinyi is familiar with, we took a seminar on emotions earlier this year, that the subject of emotion, when coupled with the mentalist framework and neuroscience, has the possibility of making sense of how human emotions work, both in their experiential nature and taking into account all of the biological information that we have about emotional experience, because this is a paradigm of experience that is so undeniably physical to us, right? But at the same time, there was always this aspect of it that we couldn't explain. So this is actually the promise and the future of neuroscience that I envision and hope to take part in, especially in the next couple of years. It became the nature of this talk and the sort of intellectual confession became apparent and necessary to me this week when I was in a class that was discussing the future of developmental psychology in the 21st century. And it became clear that the future wasn't built on any past. It was actually much like the future of literary studies. It was wherever anybody wanted to go. And so I sat quietly, and then I made the comment, well, that I think that the future of developmental psychology needs to recognize, and this is, of course, taken from Professor Greenfeld and what she says about sociology, needs to recognize that the only foundation for its existence as a separate discipline from that of biology is that it seeks to understand and explain the unique nature of human psychology, of the human mind. And from a developmental perspective, what we should be interested in is how this thing happens, begins, and then develops normally in individuals. And so this is what I think the promise of a mentalist framework is, and its relationship to neuroscience in establishing a truly social neuroscience.